So what I wanted to do was to gloss over a fair amount of high-pressure research, highlighting, of course, what my group does, although I want to put it in the context of what's going on in our community, talk a little bit about some of the condensed matter connections, and then also some of the planetary and geophysical connections. Now, since I'm glossing over a lot of material, I will encourage, I'm sure I don't need to do this, but I will encourage you to break in and ask if you want more detail on anything. Let me just start off by defining the regime that we're that I'll be discussing. It's quote-unquote ultra-high pressures, but we're nowhere near fusion, okay? So it's not really an astrophysical regime or an astronomical regime. It's really comparable to terrestrial planetary-type pressures of the order of a million atmospheres pressure. And the point of this slide is just to remind me that this, to explain that this is a regime that's of interest from, I'll call it a chemist's point of view, which is that the work done, the pressure volume or thermodynamic work done on a material and taking it up to these kinds of pressures is comparable to bonding energies. And I'd like to give you a few illustrations of that from some real data. This is a combination of data from my lab and others. One can measure the compression of a material like a simple salt like cesium iodide and basically convert that to a thermodynamic perturbation, if you want, the free energy change due to the volume compression. So we've got volume versus free energy. A million atmospheres here, 2 million, 3 million. This material has been studied actually by several groups up into this pressure range. And just to relate this back to what you might learn in a basic chemistry course, traditional thermodynamics in chemistry is related to heating samples and measuring the heat capacity, the entropy, and so on and so forth. And you can see that that thermodynamic perturbation is very small, including, in fact, if you include melting and vaporization, so no longer looking at condensed matter, you're talking about just less than a couple of EV. And so by comparison, by compressing the sample, we can really perturb the thermodynamics enormously. And that means we can look at some changes that are not maybe obvious ahead of time, but are quite remarkable, actually, in the properties, the chemical or material properties. One is that if we look at an isoelectronic comparison between cesium iodide and, of course, cesium and iodine being on either side of xenon, you might imagine that at high pressure, the difference between whether you're looking at xenon or the neighboring elements in the periodic table arranged as cesium iodide wouldn't make much difference when, in fact, the repulsive forces between the atoms dominate. And that's indeed what's found experimentally. At low pressures, of course, xenon goes off scale in terms of its volume at very low pressures. The structures are different between cesium iodide and xenon. So when it goes up to high pressures, though, it's not just that the structures become indistinguishable, but fundamentally, chemically, these become nearly indistinguishable materials. Xenon becomes a metal by about a million atmospheres pressure. Cesium iodide becomes a metal a little bit below that. But by the time you get into the couple of million atmospheres pressure range, these are quasi-indistinguishable materials. Now, we in our community look at materials like this partly to compare against theory to see if we can work with our colleagues in condensed matter theory in a productive manner. And xenon, I'll use as just one example of where we have done comparisons between, excuse me? I'll come back to that, but let me just give you a quick answer to that. We measure the volume using X-ray diffraction. I'll give you more experimental detail in just a few moments. And the pressure we measure using a spectroscopic method, but if you want, that's determined, excuse me? I'll explain that also in a few moments. I'll come back to that. Let me first try and motivate how we can compare between theory and experiment. And here, I'm very conscious of the fact that we're not in the business of trying to prove quantum mechanics being correct or anything like that. Quite the contrary, we're trying to ask the question, is quantum mechanics useful in a very engineering or material science type of application? And here's a very simple example, and I'll go to some slightly more sophisticated examples in just a little bit. We can turn to our colleagues and say, well, I can calculate the properties of silicon or xenon or what have you very, very well at low pressures, and we say, fine, now do your calculations at high pressures, and let's compare theory and experiment. And in fact, this is data, X-ray diffraction, since I've already revealed the nature of the measurements, on two phases of xenon. At low pressures, it's in a phase-centered cubic arrangement. Above 100 or 200,000 atmospheres pressure, it's in an HCP structure, so we have two lattice parameters. And in fact, if you look at the data, first of all, you see that they overlap in pressure. And the reason is that even though the phase transition, the structural transition, occurs somewhere around here, actually we get metastable coexistence of both phases over a broad pressure range. You can see in detail that the calculations are actually for zero Kelvin. There's a thermal expansion effect. If you correct for that, the curves go right through the data. You can see that more directly in that the thermal expansion at high pressures is indistinguishable. It's essentially zero on the scale of this plot. And you see that indeed the data are right, are very nicely reproduced by the theory. What's more remarkable is the theory is looking at a very, very subtle difference in energy between two phases, namely the two close-packed phases. And quite frankly, so here's a summary of the theoretical calculations of the energy of one crystal structure relative to the other. Quite frankly, the theory tells us that this material ought to transform, this rather simple material ought to transform around 100,000 atmospheres, 10 GPa. What we find experimentally is somewhere around 20 plus or minus 15. The point I'm trying to make is we're getting close to the realm where arguably, the theory is far better at this stage than the experiments. We have a huge range of metastability. That means that depending on the exact conditions under which you load the sample, how you stress it, the shear stresses and so on, you can get different results. And the experiments are in very good agreement, even despite the very small energy differences we're talking about between these crystal structures. So let me come back to the earlier theme, though, that there's an enormous perturbation of the chemical bond, if I can put it that way, with pressure. And another way to illustrate that is that there's a very large number of superconductors that have been discovered under pressure. Quite a few, it's become sort of a cottage industry in recent years. For example, sulfur and oxygen. We'll come back to the importance of the fact that oxygen becomes metallic at high pressures and indeed is a superconductor at high pressures, but sulfur, selenium, tellurium, those have been demonstrated in the last few years, iodine, bromine. Incidentally, with iodine, another interesting factor is that it metallizes as I2, as a molecular form, not as the atomic form. So a lot of small surprises, if you want, over the years. And in fact, I'm going to be very provocative now and take you one step further in pointing out that the compound cesium iodide that I alluded to a few moments ago itself becomes a superconductor at a few million atmospheres pressure. This is work by a group in Japan that's been part of this cottage industry of documenting superconductivity, relatively low superconductivity in the case of cesium iodide. I might mention that the highest TC superconductor, elemental superconductor known is sulfur, indeed, which is a superconductor at high pressures. This is quite a bit lower temperature. But what's remarkable is that this salt goes from being a perfectly simple ionic salt to becoming a semiconductor under pressure at about 500,000 atmospheres, a bit higher than that, a metal, and ultimately a superconductor if you get to high enough pressures. And one of the speculations that's in our community right now, there's both theory and experiment working on this, is if cesium iodide becomes a superconductor, there's a reasonable bet that xenon will as well. And there are some hints along those lines. So it'll be fun if one can prove that the so-called noble gas xenon is not only a metal, but actually becomes a superconductor if you squeeze on it enough. Okay. Actually not. By then, it is actually already in an HCP-like structure. And so it's gone from an FCC to an HCP structure, and that rearrangement is incredibly minimal. And then beyond that, there's no further noticeable change. Insulator to metal with increasing, yeah, that's right. It really is. And we'll come back to MOP transitions and such in a bit. And again, I invite you to ask for more details, because otherwise I'll just keep on skimming along. Now, finally, I get to how do we make these kinds of measurements? And there are many techniques. I'll mention a couple of them. But first of all, I'm primarily going to focus on so-called static methods, which in my laboratory, and most of us basically getting into this pressure range, use the so-called diamond anvil cell. Incredibly simple technology, at least in principle. Two single crystal gem quality diamonds. They're in the usual brilliant cut. You can practically see that. You turn one relative to the other, so you're squeezing on a sample between the points of the diamonds. And it's just in a very simple piston cylinder kind of arrangement, very small. Here's one of my colleague's fingers. And basically, you're just using the fact that force per unit area gives you the pressure. If you have a small enough area here, you can get to very high pressures. Now, the beauty of diamond is it's a very strong anvil material, but the real beauty of diamond is it's transparent. So that allows us to probe the sample in a variety of methods. And I won't dwell on the technicalities, but we can send laser beams into our sample to do laser spectroscopy, and in fact, one of our favorite calibrants of pressure is to look at the fluorescence of ruby. So these are the well-known R1, R2 ruby fluorescence line. It turns out that the fluorescence shifts to a deeper red as you squeeze on ruby. That's been calibrated by many groups over the years. So it gives us a means, if you distribute little particles of ruby in the sample, it gives us a means actually of measuring pressure and pressure variations across our sample. And we can send in laser beams at a much higher intensity, for example, an infrared laser, either YAG or YILF or what have you, and use that to heat our sample and measure the temperature of the sample at very high temperatures and pressures. And that then links into the planetary applications that I'll discuss. Well, very, very good question. We use a variety of metals, so before I reveal everything, you're just asking about the diamond anvils, and we have a metal plate or a gasket that we use to contain the sample so it doesn't just squirt out from between the diamonds. We can use steel. Actually, one of our favorites is spring steel, what they used to make watch springs out of, but otherwise tungsten and rhenium are very standard materials that we use, stainless steel sometimes. So that's a photograph of a pair of diamonds in black and white, actually, photograph. And if you look down through the diamond anvil cell, what you see is a sample. And so this is an image taken through a microscope of a sample, in this case iron, at a few hundred thousand atmospheres pressure. It's being backlit, but it's also being irradiated with a continuous infrared laser. This is, again, a YAG laser that's been brought down to a focal point of a few tens of microns across. This is about 150 microns across the sample right here. And so we can heat the sample, and you can see by eyeball spectroscopy that you get very high temperatures at the center of the focal spot and dropping off, I'll tell you, basically to room temperature within a few tens of microns. So the advantage is we can get the samples to very high temperatures at reasonably high pressures. We can make new material, synthesize new compounds. We can reproduce planetary interior conditions. The bad news, and this is about as technical as I'm going to get, is that we have very large temperature gradients across our sample. And so that's technically one of the problems that our community is involved with, is how do you measure those temperatures and temperature variations? Well, we do it just like in astronomy. We measure black body like radiation. If this is a schematic of the image of that hot spot, we take a slit, an imaging slit that is nominally aligned very precisely across the center of the hot spot, and then we take that image as seen through the slit and project it onto a CCD, onto a grating, and then an imaging grating actually, and onto a CCD, so that at each of these points we can disperse the spectrum and get a Planck-like distribution. In reality, it doesn't look like a Planck function because we have a lot of filters and other things that optics and so on, but in fact, once you properly null out the system response, you can get a Planck-like spectrum and get very high precision measurements of temperatures and temperature distributions across a sample. And again, that's about as technical as I want to get, just so you know that there are some experimental complications. It may not sound like such a big deal, but you should again recognize that the separation, spatial separation here is on the order of microns, and making that kind of imaging when you're looking through a window, a thick window from a distance, is not that easy. Now, the advantage, though, is that you can actually get some information and you can do some novel things. So one of the neat things is we have a puddle of really hot material that's contained at high pressures by colder sample material in general. So it's sort of self-contained. That's one advantage from a chemical point of view. And we even have some advantages regarding some of the things that we work hard to calibrate out, the fact that between our diamond anvils, you have to realize we're talking about microgram and submicrogram quantities of sample material squeezed between grams of diamond, okay, and diamond is the best heat sink known, so this is almost like an infinite heat sink on either side. And if we illuminate the sample with either a Gaussian type laser beam intensity, or another one that we like to use a lot is a so-called TEM01 star mode, so-called donut mode, we get temperature distributions that reflect the input laser power as a function of distance. So this would be for the Gaussian mode in red, and the dashed orange one would be for this donut mode. And in fact, we do get finite heat conduction that makes this almost a constant temperature distribution across here. We have temperatures also in the vertical direction that are not part, we cannot measure these directly, so we have to make sure we know how to calculate these temperature distributions. This is my final technical, I believe my final technical thing, just to say that we do measure, we do model those temperature distributions. That's a case again where what started off as being a technical problem for us has turned out to be quite amazingly useful. These are measurements of temperature distributions at the center of one of our hot spots where we're heating with this so-called 01 laser donut mode. And what you find is that you can fit the data with a thermal model, but interestingly enough, we know that we fail in fitting our measurements if we assume a constant thermal conductivity. We have to assume a thermal conductivity which goes exactly as we would expect it to for a dielectric sample. This happens to be an oxide, and the details don't really matter, an oxide at high pressures. But the point is we can get even a constraint on the thermal conductivity as a function of pressure and temperature, and that's a bit of useful information from a geophysical point of view. So what we do then to round out the whole discussion is we actually heat up our sample between diamond anvils. We have a small metal gasket plate. We heat it from one side or from two sides. We look at the thermal radiation to determine the temperature. And then we probe the sample through, typically X-rays is one of the direct probes we use at high temperatures, although we also measure electrical conductivity at very high temperatures. Most other measurements can only be done at room temperature or a few hundred degrees Celsius. So I give you the motivation from the chemical perspective that we're perturbing the system thermodynamically, but ultimately we also have planetary interests. And what I've done here is simply to summarize the nearly centuries worth of progress in static high-pressure experimental methods. Actually, Bridgman was already doing quite a bit of remarkable work in the 30s, getting up to the 100,000 atmosphere pressure range. There wasn't until the 70s that the million atmosphere pressure range was broken through. And quite frankly, the past decade or two have been mostly devoted to expanding the combined pressure and temperature range and trying to not just put your flag on a particular pressure temperature point, but actually do science. So that's the long and the short of it. The fact is, though, that at this stage it is possible, since about the early 90s, to reproduce the conditions of temperature and pressure existing deep inside the Earth and Venus. These are the estimated conditions at the center of these two planets. And to actually begin to encompass the outermost envelopes of the giant planets in terms of the conditions that are reached. Now you may say that's only a small fraction. The central pressure, for example, for Jupiter or Saturn is several fold off this axis, but the fact is we can already look at some of the interesting science in the fluid part of the atmosphere, some interesting part of the chemistry. And the other thing is, in terms of volume, we're still talking about the bulk of the planet, and we can come back to that, but we're really dominated in the future as one gets observations on the planetary interiors will be dominated by what's going on in the outer regions. Let me give you a flavor of some of the geophysical types of questions that we have, and try and relate them in a few moments, if you can hold off for a bit, to some of the more condensed matter types of issues that are at hand. Let me just say that our own planet, if you slice it in half like a melon, what you find is it's basically a ceramic exterior, or if you want to, here, it's a bowl of ceramic. that is holding liquid steel, and right at the center there's a solid inner core of the Earth that's basically a shell then of oxide surrounding liquid iron. We can say quite a bit about what's down there because of geophysical observations. I won't go into them unless you're interested in the details, but mostly they come from sonic or acoustic imaging, our colleagues in seismology looking at the resonances of the planet, the travel time of seismic waves through the planet. We'll talk a little bit about that in a few moments. We also know something about the interior because of the observed magnetic field, which is created by a dynamo-type process in the deep interior, just as you folks in the astronomical sciences know about. Then I should emphasize that in terms of actually getting your hands on a sample of the interior, that's hard to do. And as far as we know, the deepest samples come from just the outermost few hundred kilometers of the planet, as opposed to the center of the Earth being at 6,400 kilometers down. So that's a big disadvantage. And fundamentally, what we people like me do in the laboratory is to take some of those materials or synthetic, clean, pure analogs. Actually, we like to take off from the dirty rocks and actually squeeze them and see what happens as you take them to the conditions of the deeper interior. You can do that quite directly. You can take all the ugly minerals that come out from the outer part of the planet. Many of these you can see in the mountains here in California because they didn't manage to get put down into the Earth properly. You can heat them and cook them, squeeze them at high pressures and temperatures, and use X-ray diffraction to get the diffraction pattern. And in general, it's a fairly complicated business. This is actually a natural rock that's been heated at 2300 Kelvin, and it's at a few hundred thousand atmospheres pressure. And I'll simply tell you that of all these diffraction lines, there are basically three types of crystalline phases here. OPV and CPV correspond to two types of perovskite phases, and then a rock salt structured oxide. And I will not try and belabor crystal structures for you very much, but what I can tell you is that if you take any of the complex minerals of the outer part of the Earth's interior, of the Earth's mantle, and squeeze them and heat them, they all transform pretty much to this perovskite type crystal structure. A couple of different compositions, but this is the dominant one. We find that this structure is stable. It starts forming at pressures of about 200,000, 240,000 atmospheres pressure. That's it corresponds to a depth of about 600, 650 kilometers down or so. And this material, once you make it, is stable all the way to the bottom. So all these complex minerals transform more or less to this one type of mineral phase or crystalline phase. And better than that, when you go and measure the elastic properties, the density and the sound velocity and so on, the incompressibility and so on, what you find is that the properties of this material and the associated minor phases really match very nicely with the seismologists see down there. So that's the long and the short of why our community basically believes that this one material makes up the bulk of the planet. Well, it makes up over 40% of the entire planet, but makes up between 70 and 90% of the deep interior of the planet, depending on details of who you're talking to and so on. So with that as a background, you might ask, well, what kind of dynamics? This is really now sort of an onion layer picture of the planet. What kind of dynamics may be going on? And if you think back to the motivation being that at the kinds of pressures that exist at the mantle core boundary, a million, this is 1.36 million atmospheres pressure, we might expect some interesting chemistry. We can do that. We can take steel, in fact liquid steel, and put it in contact with this material and see what you get. And what you get is actually pretty remarkable. Okay, so let me just put the before and after picture. This is at slightly lower pressures. This is a bit over 750,000 atmospheres pressure. But what we have is, again, looking into one of our sample chambers, 150 microns dimension. It's back illuminated through the diamond anvils. We have a little foil of iron. We have some of this high-pressure silicate perovskite that we've made. We've combined the two. This started off as a nice square cut, but by the time you squeeze it up to 800,000 atmospheres, things mush around a little bit. Then we go in with a laser beam and we melt a puddle of iron in a couple of spots, one spot right here for, I don't know, maybe 5 to 10 minutes, almost 10 minutes. In another case, for less than a minute, what you get is a zone of intense chemical reaction that you can see right there. So you might say, well, gee, that's maybe not so unexpected, except If you have any knowledge of the steel industry, you know that that's not at all what happens at low pressures. You know that in the steel industry, what happens is liquid steel forms a scum, it's referred to as slag, okay, which is all the oxide and silicate and the other crud that comes out of the steel. The reason is because they're highly immiscible, the ionic melt of the oxide or ceramic relative to the metallic melt. And actually, as I was walking out of my office this morning, I realized that Mother Nature has shown us the same thing. For those of you who can see this, this is actually an example of that kind of a texture where there are little blobs of oxide or ceramic material, silicate material in here, intertwined like oil and water, if you want, with what used to be liquid steel. This used to be a liquid structure, since then long ago frozen. And this is actually a natural sample of a core mantle boundary in a very small object, in an asteroidal object. This is a so-called Pallasite meteorite, for anyone who's interested. So I'll leave that here, and I don't want to forget it. Okay, so you go in there and you probe, and I don't want to dwell on the details too much, but you take ceramic mantle of the Earth, put it in contact with liquid steel at very high pressures. We only find this above a few hundred thousand atmospheres, and certainly well up into the pressure range of the core mantle boundary. You make two kinds of reaction products. If you go in there and probe by chemical, electron microprobe, and also X-ray means, you find that you make a mixture of two kinds of materials. You make metal alloys intermingled with insulating, electrically insulating oxides. Now, iron-silicon alloy is well known, but I need to emphasize that this iron oxide, this is actually not known as a metal alloy when we first started in this work. So remind you, at a million atmospheres pressure, oxygen itself becomes a metal. Iron plus oxygen in the form of iron oxide also is a metal. And that means that there's tremendous potential for those two parts of our planet to interact chemically. We know that. We've actually been able to determine this. I want to focus on just a little part of this phase diagram up here. We know that as we squeeze iron oxide to very high pressures and temperatures, we make a metallic state. We've measured this using diamond anvil methods below. So along the green path, we find that we have a semiconducting behavior. It's actually a ceramic semiconductor. Above, at slightly higher pressures, it's a metal, and we reproduce this in shockwave experiments. I put this up here just to emphasize that iron oxide really has an electrical conductivity, nearly that of iron, within probably the experimental uncertainty. Also, the iron electrical conductivity has been measured by shockwave. So we're comparing apples and apples right here. The point is that we make a new kind of an alloy, which is really sitting intermediate between the exterior ceramic part and the interior steel part. There's this stuff that's in between. This is pretty crude, and quite frankly, I think we've gone maybe half a step further in understanding better how it is that these two parts of the planet, the oxygen part and the steel part, are interrelated. But we're only partway there, and we've been helped quite a bit by theoretical calculations, looking very much at the very fine interplay. For those of you who know about the transition metal oxides, you know this is a classic problem, the fine interplay between the spin ordering forces, if I can put it that way, or tendency, versus, well, with pressure, what we think is happening is actually that the band structure, the bands are being widened out, the electronic bands are being widened out, and so making this material susceptible to tremendous changes in electronic bonding state. So this was out there as a theoretical prediction, basically, that as you squeeze on these transition metal oxides, you can get very different kind of behavior. And we can actually reproduce this in the laboratory, for example, by doing spectroscopy. Something we can do to the million atmosphere pressure. I think this was the first time we went over a million atmospheres. But we can look at 600,000 atmospheres, 900,000 atmospheres, million atmospheres, the evolution of Nussbaum spectra. And to make a short story out of this, these are measurements at room temperature to start with. You see a magnetically split spectrum. This is actually an antiferromagnet at these pressures and temperatures. With increasing pressure, there's a site that shows up, a site within, first I should say, a spectral signature that corresponds to an iron site, which is non-magnetic, that's not split the way the antiferromagnetically split site is. And this was very much as had been predicted, and the abundance of this non-magnetic site goes up with pressure. And for the Nussbaum aficionados, let me just let you know that we can distinguish the evolution of the magnetically split site from the location of the non-magnetic site, which in fact we identify as being associated with the diamagnetism of this new form of iron oxide. And at high pressures, and indeed at all pressures, we can then look at the effect of temperature on this site. And this is, again, a little bit technical, but it's just to say one can see that as you cool the sample down, you can vary the abundance of the non-magnetic, the diamagnetic component, as opposed to the magnetically ordered component. So this was in very, very nice agreement with a theoretical prediction that you would get this magnetically collapsed state of iron oxide, and indeed other transition metal oxides, at high pressures. So what the interpretation, and we were really very much led by the theoretical calculations on this, is that one goes from a high spin state to a low spin state. There's quite a bit of hysteresis. We see no evidence for a volume change at room temperature. At higher temperatures, there's a small volume change and a structural change. And this tells you both the good news and the bad news. The good news is we can compare against theory, and there's quite good agreement. I'll come back and elaborate on that in a moment. The bad news is we still really don't understand what's happening at higher temperatures and pressures. This is a lesson that's really come through to us in the last few years. We have naively in our community really thought about isolating volume changes and density changes and pressure effects separately from temperature, and we always thought of temperature as being sort of a small statistical mechanical perturbation. That's not the case at all. There's something quite different happening at high temperatures, combined high temperatures and high pressures, and it's a theme that you'll see again as I turn to supposedly simpler materials like hydrogen. Let me just say, though, that unlike the case of ground state theory or calculation of ground state properties in comparison with experiment, here we're seeing qualitatively good agreement, but quantitative disagreement. And you can focus in on just one number right here, which was, again, the prediction was that this high spin state of iron oxide would be reached. In fact, it was predicted to be at 2 million atmospheres pressure. And what's even more troubling is that the older calculations were actually very close to what we observed, near 1 million atmospheres pressure. So there's sort of a factor of two discrepancy. My view is that's actually pretty good, but there's clearly not the kind of agreement as we see in very subtle differences in energetics between crystal structures in the case of something simple like the FCC-HCP transition in xenon. There are discrepancies here, and that's really nice for us and our colleagues because it means there's something you can work on in terms of improving things. We have some ideas, and that's being pursued. That's just to say, at this level, the theory and the experiment are in very good semi-quantitative agreement, not so good in detail. Let me just round out this discussion now and introduce you very briefly to the realm of geophysics. It's fine to talk about this stuff in the laboratory, but how do you know that this really happens in the real planet? And I just want to give you a flavor of the kind of spectroscopies, effectively, that can be done on the Earth's interior. Now, let me point out that what we know about the interior, as I said before, is based from seismology, which tells us the density as a function of depth, as well as the compressional wave velocity, which drops as you go from the ceramic mantle into the liquid outer core, and the transverse or shear wave velocity, which drops to zero in the liquid outer core. Indeed, for us in geophysics, I've been referring to a zone, the interface between the core, the steel or metallic core of the Earth, and the ceramic mantle of the Earth. That is really the surface of the Earth for us. I mean, for most of you in this room, if I say the surface of the Earth, you probably think where we live. But actually, in terms of the contrast in properties, the jump in density and in acoustic and elastic properties is far larger, actually, at the mantle-core interface than even between rock and air at the surface of the Earth. So I've made the mistake myself. This is really the surface of the Earth, the core mantle boundary. And so this was a cartoon to illustrate the kinds of chemical and combined dynamic interactions that might be down there, even though we don't understand fully the underlying bonding changes and so on and so forth. And so let me just elaborate a tiny bit why do we really think that there's this kind of stuff going on down there, this kind of chemistry? Well, you can probe that region, not just with looking at the travel time of seismic waves, but do one better than that by looking at waveforms. Let me just say that if you do a tomographic kind of analysis of seismic waves, it's just like in medical imaging, if you want, what you find is at the bottom of the mantle, there are variations in seismic wave velocities. This is right above the mantle core boundary. Blue means that the velocities are a little faster, a couple of percent faster than average. Red mean a little bit slower than average. And the seismologists use this kind of color scheme because, you know, if you go in the laboratory and you heat up either a rock or a metal or what have you, that the elastic properties, the elastic moduli go down, the wave velocities go down with temperature. And so they imagine that wherever the wave velocities are slow, maybe the stuff is a little hotter than where the velocities are a little bit fast. But that's just one interpretation. You find under America, North America, for example, we have fast seismic velocities, and under the Central Pacific, they're slow. You can do a lot better, though, by looking at the detailed waveforms, not just the timing of arrivals. You can get gradients in velocities and get detailed structures of different patches around the mantle core boundary. And this is really where the state of the art has pressed along in the past decade or 15 years. And so an average model for the lowermost few hundred kilometers of the mantle, the ceramic part of the Earth, and this is now going into the liquid steel core, an average model is shown by the gray. And from patch to patch, you find variations. And so they're keyed up here. You find variations that show all sorts of weird structure. And the more finely resolved the study, the more evidence, quite frankly, you find of turbidity or scattering, if I can put it that way, including actually right here underneath the Pacific Ocean, there's a so-called very anomalous patch that's been labeled an ultra-low velocity zone. Variations in velocity of not just a few percent, but a few tens, probably several tens of percent. So how do you actually go in there and say anything in detail? And so I want to give you an idea of this. You actually look at specific seismic waves that kiss along the mantle core boundary. Very often there's an ambiguity because they go in one side and come out, or you're looking at them on the exit, and we resolve that by looking at cross paths and so on. But basically you're looking at, if you want, guided modes along that mantle core interface. And you analyze these, and I'll just show you an example. This You can do this yourself. This is an example from a location that has a lot of earthquakes, the Tonga region in the South Pacific. What's shown right here is where the seismic ray paths to stations in North America enter into the core, the way it's projected here, enter into the through the core mantle boundary or exit out. So the only way you know whether you assign anomalies to under the Pacific or under North America is you have to have cross-cutting paths, and those have been studied, for example, from South America to stations out here. But let me just show you the kind of analysis or the kind of data that you have, and it's really just like acoustics in the laboratory. You can model this stuff with incredible detail. So the data for a set of earthquakes, and this is the kind of thing you do, one particular earthquake that happened in 1994, you look at seismic stations as a function of distance. This is increasing distance. These are actually in angular values. And the data are shown in black, and then you model these, the actual detailed arrival of secondary humps. And in fact, this particular secondary hump is due to one of these guided modes kissing along that mantle core interface. And it's through this kind of analysis that you can convince yourself, with some non-uniqueness, considerable geophysical non-uniqueness, that there are patches of really funny stuff along the mantle core boundary. They're patches that we are not quite sure what their lateral dimensions are. They're less than 1,000 kilometers, but they're tens of kilometers, maybe up to a few hundred kilometers of patches that are not normal. It's not just an interface between steel, liquid steel, and ceramic material, but they're either a few kilometers, this is too big, 5 to 10 kilometers above the mantle core boundary, 1 to 2 kilometers within the outermost core, or some sort of a zone of fuzziness at the core mantle boundary between the ceramic and the metal that show up to form this kind of signature. And this is just to summarize that any of these models gives us a characteristic double hump signature, which is seen at specific locations around the mantle core boundary at depth. That's not enough to prove what's going on down there. It's an indication of something really funny. Variations in wave velocities of tens of percent. But Question, yes. Yep. This slide right here? Or the previous one? I got you. I think I know what you're getting at. Let's go back here. This one? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And it's been, you could, with just a little more imagination and some writing, you'd be right out there with the rest of my colleagues speculating about why that is. So I'll tell you, the canonical story has been, if you know about plate tectonics, has been that cold oceanic crust sinks down underneath South America under Asia, may have sunk to the bottom. That was a story about 10 years ago, 8 or 10 years ago. People are very skeptical, though. This is a hugely averaged out picture, I have to tell you. It's incredibly spatially aliased, and actually the resolution here is of the order of like 2,000 kilometers. So I actually think that this gives us, this would be sort of looking at the surface of the Earth where the continents are blurred out to being equally big blobs, and you just have to realize that it's averaging out over a lot of detail. That's why the kind of analysis I'm describing is really the state of the art of looking at specific patches that have been pinged very explicitly. But I'm going to try and convince you that it's more than just somehow a combination of the core metal and the mantle ceramics sort of just sitting there. I want to really prove to you that there's, or indicate, I should say, that there's more than just some weird structure. We do that through a very roundabout means that I never believed could give us this kind of information. We actually turn back to astronomy, VLBI measurements. And quite frankly, what's been remarkable is over the last 15 years or so, the quality of data on the wobble spectrum of the Earth has been completely revolutionized by VLBI. That was recognized that was going to happen about 10 years ago, and so initial results were published in the late 1980s, very early 1990s, and now with 10 more years of data, here's what you can say. This is actually an update, even though the data span is only into the early 90s, an update of the deviation of what we understand about the Earth's wobble spectrum. Yeah, in other words, this is what the residual that's left over. And clearly there's a signal in here. And in fact, this was first studied by Bruce Buffett at the University of British Columbia. It was first studied about 10, 12 years ago, that this deviation, this unexplained residual in the wobble spectrum of the Earth has structure and can be very nicely explained in only one way that anyone's come up with. And in fact, it's an explanation that Bruce has come up with. Came up with it about 10 years ago, and we were able to re-examine it in this last year. And that is a frictional coupling, and specifically an electromagnetic coupling, at the mantle-core interface. And so the way he explains this, and I'll come back to the slide up, or the figure up top in a moment, is magnetic field lines, a magnetic field that's created in the Earth's outer liquid steel core, propagates through the ceramic mantle. And if this was a perfect insulator, then basically the outer part of the Earth would simply be a window, if you want to, at least the radial part of the magnetic field. Problem is that we believe that there's a perturbation of those field lines which get dragged around by the flow of the liquid metal. Now, this is not a superconductor, to be sure, but on geological scales, the field lines do get dragged around very, very effectively, the so-called frozen-in theorem. And dragging those field lines in, the fact is, it appears the best explanation for the anomalous part of the wobble spectrum is that there's a frictional coupling due to a finite electrical connectivity that's rigidly embedded here near the mantle core interface. Now let me explain a little bit more about this. First of all, you have to understand that the wobble spectrum, the nutation spectrum, has been studied not just for decades, but in gross terms has been theoretically studied for centuries. It's part of the theory of tides, if you want to think of it that way. And so there's a very broad understanding of the effects of the oceans, of the atmosphere, the external coupling, and so on. What was left over was this residual in terms of an unexplained amplitude to the wobble spectrum shown here in milliarcsecond for different periodicities. And the key periodicities that we're missing was a so-called retrograde, so minus sign annual, actually this is the out-of-phase component, annual retrograde component, and an 18.6 year component. This was known 10 years ago. This was not so well determined because how long has VLBI been around? Just under 20 years, right, at this kind of scale. So this is only now in the last year or so that one could actually confirm that by putting in a, if you want, a frictional effect down here at the mantle-core interface, you can fully explain the anomalous residual that's left over in the wobble spectrum of the Earth. Now, I refer to this as frictional coupling, but the fact is that we have good independent evidence to know that the fluidity of the outer core is something like that of water. So there's no way that mechanical friction can do it. And that's fundamentally why the community has devolved to this explanation of electromagnetic coupling. That is basically patches of high electrical conductivity that have to be rigidly embedded somehow at the bottom of the mantle. They could be on the core side, on the mantle side. That's the kind of detail. Point is, yes. Yeah, but the details get very complicated, and this is part of the non-unique trade-off, that if you try and put in other kinds of dissipations elsewhere, you end up popping up these signals elsewhere. So they are related in some ways, but it's not simple. I can't do it for you in on the blackboard, to be honest. Okay, so I want to give you the sense of how we go in the laboratory. We try and make measurements to guide the thinking of what might you see in the way of dynamic processes in the interior. And we're driven by the fact that at the kinds of pressures that exist in the deep interior, there are novel phenomena that may be taking place, novel in terms of what is normally observed near the Earth's surface. I want to briefly now expand outward, and I realize time is getting a little short. I want to briefly expand outward to where I see the field heading. And here I do want to talk a little bit about work that's been done jointly with this graduate student working with Lars, Robin Benedetti. Now is to look at what's going on, what kind of chemistry might be going on inside the so-called dirty giant planets. For our solar system, that would be Uranus and Neptune, that are rich not just in hydrogen and helium, but in various molecular species. Now you know that molecular chemistry is out there with years, decades, almost centuries worth of data. Almost nothing is known about these systems at high pressures until recently. Here again, we're driven by theory, and our colleagues, in this case in Trieste, made a prediction from molecular dynamics simulations that if you take methane, that basically as a function of pressure, it would tend to form associated molecules, basically polymerize, all the way to the point where at a few hundred GPa, at a few million atmospheres pressure, you would actually get the formation of carbon that links up together to form finite nuclei of diamond. This is something we could go into the laboratory and check. And to make a long story short, we take methane, we take its spectrum. So this is the infrared absorption spectrum. Yes, it's methane. We heat it up in different spots. This is again looking inside our diamond anvil cell. We make some sort of a crud, and we measure that. What we find is some evidence for polymerized hydrocarbon in there. This is a very good. This is at about, this is at very high pressure, a few hundred thousand atmospheres pressure. We've heated it, and it's actually fluid while we heat it, okay? And we form some sort of new stuff in here. I'm about to show you what we form. We can go in here into these dark spots and probe them by spectroscopy. And for those of you guys who are in the CVD business, you're supposed to, chemical vapor deposition business, good. It's an in-joke. You're supposed to recognize, this is a very famous line in that literature, this is the Raman vibrational line for diamond. And we see indeed that very much as our colleagues have predicted, that we form diamond inside this methane at high pressures and temperatures. Let me summarize this again. So we actually form diamond by cooking up methane at high pressures and temperatures. And we can confirm this by X-ray diffraction and so on and so forth. So to pull this together, the point is that we, again, are motivated by theory. Check it out. We find qualitatively very good agreement, but quantitatively, it's no good at all. They told us that we were going to find diamond at pressures of a few million atmospheres. We find it a few hundred thousand atmospheres, a factor of 10 off, actually a factor of 20 off. Nevertheless, the point is that the theory has very much helped us in motivating the experiments and helping us to interpret the experiments. And so I didn't want to make a big deal out of this because it's easy to wave one's hands too much and speculate overly. But the fact is that inside a planet like methane, we know spectroscopically there's methane in the atmosphere, but in the deeper interior, the models that we have for the interior composition of Neptune or Uranus indicate the proportion of carbon, of hydrocarbon that's in there. If you calculate what would happen to that methane in terms of dissociating to diamond, the diamond is just going to sink out as diamond hailstones, right? You calculate what kind of energy is associated with that. Remarkably enough, if, just to give you an idea, if it's spread out over the age of the solar system, it's enough energy to provide the luminosity of Uranus and Neptune. Okay, now, I've said way too much. That's hugely speculative for a lot of reasons. First of all, if there was this kind of separation of dense, in this case carbon, sinking to the center, just like for our planet, it's the steel of the core that sank to the center to form the core of the Earth, right? Okay, so in the case of Neptune and Uranus, that kind of separation probably would have happened quickly and early on. I'm not really claiming it's still happening now. And more than that, all we've done is study methane. We haven't put in all the other stuff. We're in the process of looking at the other materials, water, ammonia, and then mixed in with hydrogen and helium. But I did want to mention that there are predictions for the behavior of water and ammonia at high pressures and temperatures. This is from the same group in Trieste. And there's some really interesting planetary aspects, but I also wanted to mention there's some more basic aspects that they're coming across that are very intriguing to us. For example, at very high pressures of a few hundred GPa, a few million atmospheres, the distinction between the crystal and the fluid state becomes squishy, if I can put it that way. There's a so-called superionic state. Is it really crystalline? Is it not crystalline? Is it crystalline just because their calculations are encapsulating a very short time period? The sense, what with the physics of melting at these conditions is very, very clearly known. Very unclearly known, I'm sorry, for the say it backwards. Okay, and so now with that, let me just touch on one last, I know in the last minute or so, touch on one last thing. And indeed, much of our community has been quite interested in this. The primary species of the giant planetary atmosphere is hydrogen. There's good indications that at high temperatures it becomes metallic in the molecular form. And there are indications from direct measurements that the conductivity becomes that of metal. So these are measurements done a few years ago at Livermore. And actually these values for the electrical resistivity are very important to us in the planetary business because, let me show you what there was for comparison before with theory. Theory bounded the predicted electrical conductivity to plus or minus a couple of orders of magnitude. The green curve shows a fit to the data, which were measured to just about up here and then extrapolated onward. And makes a difference whether you're off by a few orders of magnitude one way or the other, because we think in our community, we would like to think that we have an idea of the force balances associated with a magnetic field. And the scaling is such that on the assumption that the forces are dominated by magnetic forces balancing off against rotational forces, just like in our own atmosphere, we have a geostrophic type of balance that forms, you know, the hurricanes and the cyclonic motions we see. If that were true, then this scaling for the magnetic field magnitude relative to the density, the rotation rate, and the electrical conductivity ought to fit. And indeed, when you put in the experimentally measured values for the electrical conductivity, you come very close to what's observed. If we were off on the electrical conductivity by a few orders of magnitude, it would say that there's something wrong in our understanding of the planetary dynamics. But it's not that simple. There's still something dreadfully wrong in this business. And our colleagues at Livermore have really demonstrated that. We're currently working with these guys using not mechanical shockwave measurements, but laser-driven shockwaves. And I just want to give you the bottom line because it's not my group's work, but many of you perhaps have seen this already. This is deeply embarrassing, what was discovered about a year ago, a year and a half ago. And that is when you squeeze hydrogen to the million atmosphere, the 100 GPa range, using laser-driven shockwaves, the amount of compression is something like 50% higher than had been predicted. Okay, this is a huge discrepancy. People were worrying about the sort of percent level. Now there are big error bars here, and you'll notice that the data under shock loading, laser driven shockwave, tend to sort of go asymptotically up or actually turn around a little bit. This is because as you drive a stronger and stronger shockwave, you're basically thermally heating the material rather than compressing it. So there's a big thermal component in here. Point is, there's still very deep mystery in what's going on in these materials. And it's different depending on when you squeeze on it at room temperature or whether you squeeze on it at high temperatures. You get metallization under these laser-driven experiments, metallization happening as low as 0.6 of a million atmospheres, 60 GPa, far lower than what was found in the older mechanical shock compression studies. I briefly showed you data that showed metallization at much higher pressures. If you squeeze on this material statically at room temperature, what you find is nothing up to about 2 to 3 million atmospheres. Temperature is playing a huge role. I lay this out here because to us in the community, this is now very mysterious. We used to think it was just how closely you bring the atoms together that make a difference. But this technology is very exciting to us because with diamond anvil cells, you can only go so far before you break the anvils, or the size of your sample is too small, you can see anything. With a partial equilibrium. That's a very good question. We can come back to it. It's partial thermodynamic equilibrium. We get humongous pressures, enormous pressures. This is on a simple hydrocarbon, polystyrene. You know, we're not, the data are not plotted log-log. Pressures of the order of 100 megabars, 100 million atmospheres, okay? And there's only one other time that our community has seen these kinds of experimental measurements. And that was in the bad old days of underground nuclear testing, okay? So I have a colleague in Russia who bemoans this at length in his book, that it's too bad we don't have that methodology anymore. But in fact, for the future, he means purely from a scientific point of view, for the future, this is a direction using the laser-driven shockwaves. I just wanted to give you a flavor of where I see things headed. And it's better than that, because I've talked about our transparent diamond anvils. So now I can come in with a diamond anvil where I pre-compress a sample to some initial state and put it in front of a humongous short laser pulse and tune actually the final pressure temperature state that I'm going to get to. And so that's really where I was getting to in this talk. For the future, we see an evolution from going from the sort of million atmosphere to the tens or hundreds of millions of atmosphere pressure range. And that means it's a different kind of chemistry that we're looking at. This has been conventional chemistry. We've been bonding the outermost electrons at electron volt energies. But actually, we really think in this regime, the combination of temperature and pressure, this is clearly pre-fusion, but it's a totally novel area of chemistry where you can talk about, if you want, kiloelectron volt chemistry. And of course, in terms of the application, we're talking not just about planetary interiors, but beginning to talk about giant planets and small stellar interiors. And just to give you a taste again, theory tells us it's not just going to be simple-minded as one reads in the textbooks of eventually all the atoms become Thomas Fermi-like. That's not true at all. Actually, there are already indications, clear indications, theoretically and experimentally, that, for example, many materials go from metallic to insulating under pressure, okay? In the case of lithium, that's now been shown experimentally. It actually goes to becoming lithium 2 and becomes insulating. And theoretically, nickel is predicted to become an insulator at high pressures. I want to give you a few tastes of that, that interesting chemistry is available to us in this very new regime. Thank you very much. Yes? They are beginning to be looked at. But I'm glad you asked the question because I think right now we are at a state where we need to redo those models much more thoroughly. There are issues of chemical equilibrium. So even those high compressions may, the real compression may be even higher yet. These may be not fully relaxed equations of state. On the other side, we're hoping that this will drive people to go back and do a new generation of observations on giant planetary interiors. The interior structures are very poorly known from an observational point of view, and the way you'd want to do this is just like with the Earth or just like with the Sun, which is to look at the oscillations. And some of us have been talking about how there may be opportunities to do that. So observationally, we have a motivation as well as from the experimental and modeling side to do that. One can only imagine. And again, I want to be a little cautious, just like the comments I made about our work on methane and the separation of diamond. You can start spinning off great stories, but much more work needs to be done on, you know, more realistic multi-component systems and all that. But clearly the indications are to sort of first order, there are going to be some big shifts in the interior models. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Oh, very good. Yeah, very good. And again, I apologize. I know I've glossed over a huge amount of stuff. I've not filled in any real information on how we get to a lot of these conclusions. So let me just say, for the Earth's interior, it's remarkably difficult to get an absolute determination of temperature. And probably the single best pinning point for deep temperatures is from experimental work among several groups studying the melting point of iron and iron alloys at very high pressures. We know that this outer core of the Earth at 1 million to 2 million atmospheres pressure is liquid because it does not propagate shear acoustic waves. You can go into the laboratory and make measurements. It's an area that's somewhat controversial. The measurements are still difficult. I was actually shocked to find out there are no absolute calibrations for, you know, doing spectroscopic determinations of temperature above about 1,000 degrees. So when you're talking about 2,000-3,000 degrees, you're really extrapolating. But the fact is that, having said all of that, the real uncertainty is we don't know the exact composition of what's down there. We have good evidence it's an iron-rich alloy. We know it's not pure iron. The density is about 10% off from being pure iron. Whatever else is in there will affect the melting point. So that's the level of argument. Having said all of that, you can bound the temperature that is required to melt iron and iron alloys and steel and so on, and use that as a constraint, use the melting point of the rocky materials, as perovskite alluded to, that's also been measured by several groups. The point is that you come up with temperatures of something like 4,000 Kelvin for the outer part, the liquid powder of the Earth's core. That's comparable with what we know for shallower levels. Deeper down, temperatures have been extrapolated and estimated for the center of the Earth as being in the range of about 5,000-6,000 Kelvin. So it's close to the surface temperature of the Sun, maybe a little bit higher actually, with an uncertainty right now, quite generous, you know, 10-15% or so in temperature. So it's based on this interplay between the laboratory observations and the acoustic observations of the interior. I'm sorry, the energy source, yeah. Canonically, okay, since the 50s, a big favorite form of energy for the entire planet has been radioactive decay. People have measured the amount of radioactivity in meteorites and also in samples from the interior. Indeed, you can sustain, you can justify in your own mind that you can get a few thousand degrees that way, maybe the full temperature of the planet. What's new, and in my opinion, has not really yet diffused into our full consciousness in our community, is a better understanding of the original heating of the planet just by putting it together. Now, this is like an undergraduate problem. If you calculate that, depending on how you do the calculation, you come up with something like 50 or 70,000 Kelvin, but the planet can't retain that heat as it's accumulating, so it's a very messy problem. And that was sort of set aside until the mid-1980s, the realization, I think is the best way to put it, that very likely when the planet Earth accreted or accumulated, like other giant, like other terrestrial planets, in the final stages, we believe it gets hit by objects of comparable size. And this, from a modeling point of view, tied in with the then interpretation of the relatively new Apollo samples. I mean, they'd been looked at from the 70s up through the mid-80s. All of a sudden, everything came together in a beautiful understanding that the moon basically got splashed out of the Earth 4.5 billion years ago. As soon as you admit that, that there's giant impact late in the formation of the planet, that generates enormous heating. That alone by itself can actually heat the planet to its current state. The kind of simulations that have been done by Al Cameron and others will indicate temperatures on the order of, again, 50,000 Kelvin are locally being made. So having said all that, now I'd say there's a trade-off. We don't know if it's 50-50 radioactivity and the secretional energy, but in that ballpark. I tend to be more in favor of more of the original accretion heating, but others like the radioactivity part, and it's an area that's being studied quite intensely. Oh yeah. Well, we knew that anyway. Well, with Kelvin, I mean, he had many difficulties, because even though he was a pioneer in understanding what we now label as hydrodynamics, he didn't realize that hydrodynamics really applies to the planet. And so the heat transfer itself is predominantly by convection, and things like that really have been revolutionized in the past 50 years or so of earth science.
Yeah.
Very large.
Yeah,
and
static?
No. And actually, there's some really neat modeling that's been done, which is effectively what I call the hot mulled wine problem, which is how far do the little bits of spice get stirred up in your pot of wine as it's being warmed up from the bottom. It's the same kind of idea, and it was nice. You can tune things, but you can actually drag up, you know, sort of percent level of 5% or something like that, level of stuff from the core itself up quite high up into the Earth's mantle. And our colleagues in geochemistry who measure trace elements of this, that, and the other thing, it fits in with some of the anomalies that they see in places like Hawaii, regions where we think there may be material coming from very deep. This is one. Okay, so for Uranus and Neptune, actually, if there's any validity at all to these kinds of results, that carbon has sunk to the bottom, you would get a layer, and it's not that thick a layer, many hundreds of kilometers thick, that if it's there, actually, would really show up as part of an acoustic signature if you can measure the normal modes of those planets. Because diamond is so fast, it would be a really tremendous ringing signal for those planets. So I'm trying to say that to motivate people to go out there. Yeah, we're not going to go mine diamond down there. It's easier to make in the lab. Yeah, just purely, and this is purely gravitational settling kind of problem, gravitational energy of release. Yeah. Oh, so what we've done is we've just taken how much gravitational energy releases. Again, like an undergraduate problem, just the energy release, and said if we spread that out over the age of the solar system, 4.5 billion years, it's comparable to the luminosity. But again, it's just to give an idea that the energetics associated with this dissociation process are of planetary significance. It's not a trivial amount. Having said that, I suspect that any unmixing probably mostly happened early on. All of the planets are luminous. Yes. Yeah, all of the planets. Now, I was just trying to hesitate whether, for Pluto, it's really down at very low emission, but I think it's fair to say that they all are. Yeah. Yeah. If I said that, I misspoke. This was made in a very small object, the size of an asteroid. This is actually a low-pressure phenomenon. It's just to say, this is exactly what you find in the steel industry when you have slag and steel together. It's this immiscible mixture of the melts that freezes together like that. So this is a low-pressure version. At high pressure, we see this would all be uniform. It would all be a fully reacted material. Okay. Yep. Not really. It turns out, okay, so there are two classes of meteorites, broadly speaking. About 90% of the meteorites that are found, if reliably sampled, are the rocky kind. About 10% are the metal kind. a tiny fraction, so those come from the cores and the mantles of asteroids. A tiny fraction come from the core mantle boundaries of those asteroids, and this is one of those rare examples. Okay, so this is quite a rare kind of meteorite, but they're enormously interesting for us as an analog, or if you want a sample, of the kinds of materials that are the building blocks for the original planet. So we imagine that these chunks of metal and rock come in as debris get intermixed. And during the growth process, especially triggered perhaps by giant moon-forming impacts and so on, allow the planet, our Earth, and to unmix 4.5 billion years ago. And that's a very early process. The geochemists refer to that process of unmixing as differentiation. And we think that that happens very, very early on. Thank you.